I'm Sophie Black. This is my new podcast, The Trapdoor. You've just been listening to my daughter. I think she's laughing when she makes that noise. She sounds like a dolphin. She makes that noise quite a lot. I hope she's laughing, is all I can say. And that was my son. That is a siren going past. I live in Brixton, so you will be hearing that a lot. I've only just waited for the sound of the nursery that is next door to quieten down, where I can constantly hear like the muffled sound of crying children. And I kind of, even when my kids aren't here or they're asleep, I sort of walk around like a woman possessed, thinking I can hear my child crying upstairs or downstairs or whatever. I have stairs. Other things about me. Let's get back to the podcast. Podcast is called Trapdoor, and this is because a friend of mine once described having kids to me as like falling through a trapdoor into a world that you never knew existed. In many cases, a sort of quite gendered world where suddenly you're at home with a baby and being a bit of a housewife and having been an independent woman for a long time and had your own career, this is quite terrifying. It's also quite amazing, but this is what I wanted to talk about, how your world changes, how your life changes once you've had kids. Obviously in the kind of practical sense, but also in the emotional sense, how it changes your relationship with your partner and your families and your friends and your sense of self, your career, the whole caboodle. We'll be talking to both mums and dads, men and women, about their experience and trying to get, I think it's probably worth saying at this point, a slight qualifier. You know, people can only talk about their own experience, and obviously parenthood is quite a sensitive topic. So no one is saying this is how one should bring up your kids, or this is how one should feel when you're pregnant or have a baby. So, you know, take it as different opinions and certainly not a manual as to how to respond to parenting. Respond to parenting? Do you respond to it? I think most people just do it. Anyway, in the first episode, I had the pleasure to speak to Anna Crilly, actor, comedian, writer, and all-round brilliant person. You will know her from her amazing sketch show, Anna and Katie, that was on Channel 4 in 2013, I believe. I remember the date specifically because I was also in it. A very, very small role, but I did appear intermittently in various guises. It was a sketch show. In this episode, we actually talk about that and talk about a table read that I had to once do for Anna and Katie. For those of you who don't know, a table read is when actors sit round a table and basically read the script so that other people, more important people, can decide whether or not that stays in, that stays out, or the show gets made or doesn't get made. Anna is also known for lots of other things, including playing Magda in Lead Balloon. She also appeared recently in Death in Paradise, which we also talk about. Had a horrible time having to stay in the Caribbean for 2 weeks on her own without her son. It's very traumatic, as you'll hear. And she came in to talk to me back in June, complete with a vaporizer. I'm so pure, I don't even actually know what they're called. You know, like the fake fag. She came in with one of them and proceeded to tell me how it was going to affect the the interview.
I'll do it quite subtly, but you will hear sort of a gentle sucking. I don't know how you feel about that.
No, I think that's fine. I think it will add to the drama.
Just going to recline.
You can just... I can ask a question then.
Ooh, cramp.
I can ask a question and then you'll hear...
Yeah.
And it's you'll just... know it's a toughie. Listeners will know it's a toughie. It doesn't sound like an inhale. Now you're exhaling. Well, this could be a whole series in itself. Different people vaping.
Talk about your vape.
Talk about your vape. .com. So first of all,
yes,
I would like you to paint a picture of what your life was like immediately before you got pregnant.
Oh. Okay. Well, my husband and I, William, so we got married in 2011 and I got a series commissioned that year, and I also did a really embarrassing set of commercials for more money than you have ever had in your life, Sophie. No regrets. So suddenly we were not loaded, but we had money to spend. We could kind of do stuff to the house, and I could afford to buy the clothes that I wanted and the nice face products, and we were probably spending too much on going out for meals at the pub. And if my husband didn't hate hot weather, we probably could have gone on holidays.
We went on holiday with your husband.
In fact, you were
so well off, you lent me money to get on that holiday.
Did I?
You were loaded.
Did you give it back?
Let's just say I did. Let's just say.
You see, this
for
is
the purposes
point.
Of this podcast. Let's consider doing this podcast me paying you back.
Oh.
The exposure that this is going to give
oh,
you.
Oh, right, you're doing me the favour.
That's right.
I see.
It's going to be huge.
Funny, I hadn't thought about it like that, Sophie. I thought when you said, would you come and do the podcast, I thought it was perhaps me doing you the favour.
No, that's why it's useful that this came up now at the beginning, because you may not have seen it that way, but it's going to be huge, huge exposure for you.
Is it?
It's going to be a bit of a game changer.
Well, I'm excited.
Yeah.
We were basically going to bed when we wanted, waking up when we wanted, working hard. We had the dog, so, you know, couldn't get up that late and that responsibility. But, yeah, the life of Riley, I would say.
Yes.
Cut to.
And then what happened?
Oh, no. There's two lines. My husband found a Google search on the laptop that said not excited about pregnancy.
That you had done.
That I'd obviously done. And bless him. And like, he must have... It's hard for a bloke, isn't it? Because they're not physically going through that. Emotionally they are, but they're not physically going through that. And so they must feel very helpless when they realise that their loved one is like, oh, right, I'm pregnant.
Do you think, because I remember you having quite a difficult pregnancy.
Awful.
So do you think
that...
It was
a living hell. And I'm not... Yeah, it was awful.
Tell me why.
So I had migraines, focal migraines, and migraines with aura. It's kind of what they're described as, in my teens. And then I'd sort of grown out of them. But I'd have like maybe one or two a year, nothing like debilitating. But when I have them, I get flashing lights in my eyes, so I can't see out of one eye. The side of my body goes numb. So from my tongue, my side of my tongue goes numb, my arm goes numb, and my leg goes numb. And I vomit quite a lot.
Oh my God.
And then the headache starts. So I can't see. I'm partly dead down one side and I'm being sick.
And when that's all happening, you're like, and I'm going to be slapped in the head with a headache at the end of this. That's what I'm going to be rewarded with.
And then the the hangover from that the next day, even if I sleep it off, it's every time you sort of bend down slightly, the thumping comes back. So that'll last a couple of days.
Can I just ask as a side note to this, when people say, oh, I think I've got a migraine.
No, there's no,
do you
I
want
think.
To punch them in the face?
Sometimes I have said quite a lot, you'd know if it was a migraine.
Yeah.
Because it's completely debilitating. You cannot function.
No, I get this.
Like if I'd, there was one day when I'd driven the dog out for a walk. It wasn't, you had to drive.
The lead was just out the car.
He loved it.
You were just smoking a fag in the front seat.
No, he had his roller skates on, not that cruel. And I realised I was getting a migraine, and Will was out all day in town, and that's it, that's game over. I can't drive because I can't see. I was thinking, Christ, what am I going to do?
And so was that worse when you were pregnant then?
So I'd grown out of them. And then once I was pregnant, within, I think, the first 6 weeks of pregnancy, I started getting migraines 4 times a week. Whoa. So it was pretty much every other day. And sometimes I could go to bed and sleep it off for, 3 or 4 hours and wake up. And sometimes then a couple of hours later, I'd get another one.
Oh my
it was
God.
Just, it was relentless. And debilitating and scary as well, because I went to the GP and she said, oh, there's no product on the market that you can take for this. And even if you could, it's not so much the headache that's the awful part, it's the not being able to see. And she said, and once you've had the baby, I'm going to send you for an MRI to check that you're not having a series of strokes. Which is exactly the sort of news that you want
to hear when you're sitting, when you've got pregnant. A whole pregnancy in front of you.
Yeah, still months and months to go. It was like...
And were you? Were you having a series of mini strokes?
It turns out, Soph...
No.
It was just migraines. So that was pretty much my pregnancy. And then... Oh, I don't know, you probably remember, but... your ribs swell and it was catching the cartilage in between, so I was comfortable in no position. There was not one position I could sit comfortably in. And then you feels like your womb's going to drop out your bum because you have that pressure, and I had that for ages.
Yeah.
It was just like, this is the shittest thing I've ever known.
And do you think, like, did you really want to have kids before...
I think it was more of a feeling of, I don't want to get to the end of my life. And I know at some point I will want kids. So probably when I'm 37 and, married to a wonderful man and financially stable and own our own home now would probably be the time to do it. But it was more of a fear of regret at that point because my career was great at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was like, I don't want to give all this up. And Will was very keen, to start a family. So we got on and did it.
Do you think that your experience of pregnancy impacted your view of motherhood in any way? Did it make it harder to sort of bond with the idea of this baby, or was that very separate in your head?
I think because I hated pregnancy so much, I couldn't wait to get him out.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, I didn't feel like blooming and wonderful and, one with my child while I was, carrying him around. I just felt miserable and in pain. But that made the birth more exciting because I knew the minute I had him, those symptoms would be gone, or at least that was what the GP was telling me.
Yeah.
And so once I had him, I was on cloud nine.
Yeah.
And I'd felt better than I'd felt in 9 months or 9.5 months or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I felt incredible. Lack of sleep, like nothing compared to what I'd been through.
So that's interesting because I think a lot of people who have really kind of easy, like in a way I did, where I had quite an easy, bouncy pregnancy And then the birth was kind of okay, but then I got slammed with not being able to breastfeed and that being really hard and very emotional and a real shock. And I hadn't been prepared. Like, it was literally like, oh, I thought this was just going to skip along exactly how you mean. And it was
actually... So we had exactly the opposite experiences then, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you're going to get slapped in the face, basically. It's just when.
At some point by something.
Yeah.
Yeah. That whole breastfeeding thing, you know, they've sort of ditched that now, and they're not allowed to have the boob women.
I was told when I was, I told this to someone yesterday and they couldn't believe it, but I was in a, you know, those milk spots where they kind of help you breastfeed and stuff. And basically I think there was something wrong with my boobs because it just didn't
work.
Yeah, well.
I've always said there's something wrong with your boobs.
A bit weird. And so anyway, I was in this milk spot and we were obviously feeding him formula because otherwise he would have wasted away.
Died.
We had to be readmitted to hospital because he lost so much weight because I was basically not producing any milk. And we were told to leave the room because you weren't allowed to feed baby's formula in that room.
Can
you imagine, like,
God's
when
sake.
You're so hormonal and you're so already, I felt like such a failure and that I was letting him down, and it was such an emotional
awful.
Thing. I felt like I was, you know, kind of feeding him KFC, you know, and it was just horrible. And it took a really long time for the kind of other people who I knew who'd gone through a similar thing to slowly kind of raise their voices and go, it's okay, your baby's going to be absolutely fine, and fuck those people, man.
That's awful.
You know, yeah, so,
And I think, now they've ditched that whole campaign, haven't they? And I remember seeing all the signs around the hospital at UCH saying, well, it was the stats of how likely it was that your child would be readmitted to hospital through an infection if you did not breastfeed.
Yeah.
And I just thought, at the time, I thought, that can't be right.
No.
Like, I'm, you
it's
know,
massively
educated.
Exaggerated, I think. I think, you know, all in all, you know, and also the thing is, when it comes to the human body and human beings, you kind of can't apply these statistics. You know, when I had Zach when I was 39, 3 weeks off my 40th birthday. I then had Sadie.
Big mistake. Ruined.
Ruined. And then I had Sadie 3 weeks after my 41st birthday. So when I was pregnant with Sadie, because I was over 40, suddenly everyone, alarm bells, everyone's checking, you know, as if I'm, you know.
Yeah.
And I kept sort of saying, I literally had a baby a year ago and it was fine.
Yeah.
So my instinct is, it's kind of going to be fine. Let's do something if something, you know, turns out not to be fine.
Yeah.
But it's all very well having statistics. Yes, I've gone over that 40 mark, but I have just had a baby and it was all fine. So the likelihood is it's going to be fine. And you know what? It was fine.
It's all a bit letter of the law, isn't it?
It's all very much, and it kind of has to be. I'm not sure you can kind of evaluate things in a different way, but it kind of means that then, you know, so if you work out that there's a 12% likelihood of you having asthma if you have breast milk, and a 13% likelihood of you having asthma if you're formula fed, then A, you're not likely to either way, you know, and B, it doesn't, that by the way is not a real statistic, but it was something like
there's
that.
Something
the margins
I
were so
to,
slim
yeah.
that you're kind of like, actually, well, do you know what? I was breastfed as a child. I have so many allergies. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, it doesn't work like that. It's not a guarantee. And I think we live in a sort of world whereby people think that if they do certain things, like if I don't smoke, I'm not going to get cancer. Well, you will. I mean, you can. Like, you can't control everything. You can try and have a healthy lifestyle, and you can try and do the things that you believe to be best. But you know what? Life is chaos, and things are just going
to
happen.
Most cancers and illnesses are not really down to lifestyle anyway, isn't
that
right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's genetic.
Yeah,
and
that's the biggest thing.
Stan's dad and his granddad and most of his uncles, well, his uncle and his aunt have got asthma. I'm pretty sure me bottle feeding him
is not going to make
turn around
exactly,
and blame me.
Exactly.
The blame is the Andrews rubbish lungs.
Because it is their fault.
Let's portion
let's
some blame
it, yeah.
here.
Not me.
Also wanted to talk to you about work and how being pregnant and then having a young baby, how that affected that, not only in terms of like physically getting work or not getting work, but also in terms of the work you wanted, or, you know, how did it change your focus?
Yeah, I mean, when I was pregnant, regardless of, you know, at points being the size of a house, the migraines meant that it just wasn't an option.
Yeah,
absolutely not an option. And actually, feeling under a certain amount of pressure to keep the pregnancy quiet, like I never put it on Facebook, because, you know, producers, directors, and people that I know, you know, would look at that, and I know that they would immediately write you off. And so I went to a wedding reception when my little boy was about 10 months old. So he's not like a newborn. He's 10 months old. You know, he's nearly a year old.
Yeah.
And a producer saying to me, "Oh, hi, Anna. We thought of you for something the other week, but we knew you'd just had a baby." So, and it makes your blood boil. Yeah, yeah. A, because that's my decision to make, not yours. And B, I haven't just had a baby.
No.
He's nearly a year old. And then I thought about that a lot, and I suppose it's really what it is Chinese whispers. In our industry, everyone's always talking about each other. So if somebody said to me 6 months after Sadie was born, "Oh, how is Sophie?" I would probably go, "Yeah, she's great. She's just had a baby." That person then, in 2 months' time from then, bumps into another person. "Oh, how's Sophie Black?" "Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen her for ages, but apparently she's just had a baby."
Yeah,
so you've basically, as an actor, you've basically just had a baby for about 10 years.
From
what I can gather.
Yeah.
And it's not out of any malice on anyone. It's just, you know, once you're out of that social circle of, you know, going to the Phoenix every night, it's just hearsay as to what you're up to.
Yeah.
So it's only really been the last year or 2 years that I've been back out, and it's a bit of an uphill climb, but I've got there now.
And how does it differ? Like, how are you different in your approach to work compared to before you had Stan?
You think about it less, you care less, and therefore you're better at your job.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is.
I wonder as well, I wonder, because I've had kids later, whether that's also just growing up, whether this has just like triggered a kind of level of maturity that maybe I should have had before.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think you and I were talking about this recently, about what has being in your 40s taught you. You feel you give less of a toss about what other people think of you. You're far more focused, far sharper than you've ever been. I'm learning how to mature as a human being in a way that I've never felt before. And that's partly to do with having a little boy who I'm responsible for, but partly it's an age thing. And but then I think, God, I am such a slow developer.
So do I think that.
Like, why? I'm 43. Why do I only feel like this now about my world?
I know. But also that, you know, I mean, you know, I meet younger people, people who are 10 years younger than me, and have that already.
Yeah.
And jealous. I mean, we met probably in our early 30s, maybe late 20s. And I mean, I can't speak for you. I was nowhere near that.
No,
I mean,
no.
Absolutely nowhere near
that. I was an absolute lost cause at 30.
Yeah.
Like, I look back now and just think,
I was just having fun.
It was so stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. I was literally just
But clueless. About. Like, literally clueless.
Yeah.
I remember...
Do you know what? One thing I do remember, which is really funny, because it's kind of not like you, but I do remember it. I think it was my birthday. And we won't mention, but I was going out with someone who basically kind of ditched me on, not like forgotten it was my birthday and had made plans, and I'd kind of like taken the day off work and whatever, and I literally had nothing to do, and I think you were staying with
I was
us?
Staying with you at the time,
and so we just had a nice, we went, right, let's just have a nice day, and it was really nice, and I remember walking across Brockwell Park and you saying something like,
Was it terribly profound?
No, because it was something like, and it was probably my 33rd birthday.
I think, yes.
And you said, when you're 34, they'll stop giving you IVF on the NHS. And I remember thinking, I don't, like, even, but I remember being quite impressed that you even knew that. And that was even something that I needed to think about.
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry.
It's funny, though, isn't it? Because it's actually not like you. But I think you were saying it in a kind of way which is, mate, this is something that needs to be in your head. Or maybe you were saying it in, it's all right, you got another year.
God, what a terrible human being. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. No, I didn't take it in a bad way. This only shows, I took it in a way which was like, oh, she's got her shit sorted out. She knows exactly what she's doing. She knows. She's got all her ducks in a row.
I had my shit so sorted, I was having to sleep on your floor in Brixton, as I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't, I kind of had to, I think my mum had to die before I kind of went, oh no, I do want kids. So I was that thick. I think I would have just carried on. I would have been like, if my mum's still alive, still be dicking around.
Well, I think...
going out with kind of just, like, completely inappropriate men who are never going to commit. And me going, oh, it's just that maybe if they've just got a really tough time with work, once that dies down...
I can save them.
It will be, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And you see, I understand him in a way that other people don't.
But I think your 40s is a real eye-opener in terms of... realizing your mortality. And also, so we had a lovely couple that were our neighbours in London, that we're still really good friends with, and he was 75 and he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and this was the beginning of last year, and it was that moment of realization of, oh, right, okay. I could see that if I was diagnosed with lung cancer at 75, I'm not going to feel any differently about that diagnosis than I would do at 42.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's suddenly you hit your 40s and you can see towards the end of your life,
yeah, yeah,
in a way that you can't in your 30s.
Yeah.
That just feels like, you know, a million miles away.
Yeah.
And now... it's like, no, I can see.
This is...
because, yeah, I might live till I'm 73. So I've only got 30 years left on this planet.
Yeah.
And that's almost a positive moment of clarity. Because that's the moment where you go, right, it's time to start living properly, not imagining that that's 10 years down the line.
Yeah.
Doing it now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And going for things now and not...
I would just sort of take whatever just was thrown in my lap,
yeah,
relationships included, work included, literally would just kind of go with whatever was around. I know. But yeah, but I think it's kind of part of maturity, and maybe you're forced to do that when you have kids, where you have to sort of suddenly plan whether it's what school they're going to go to.
Yeah.
You have to make a decision. You have to go, right, what kind of people are we? What do we want for our kid? What do we, you know, who are we? Therefore, who is he or whatever?
Yeah. And like the school thing, and then you start to, like, what I'm looking into at the moment is, I can't believe. What I'm looking into at the moment is how to put his child benefit, start a pension with it. Like, who am I? But that's what I'm looking into at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
That's proper, like, that's when he's in his 60s. Like, that's how far ahead I'm thinking now.
Yeah, yeah.
And that all feels relevant and now, and like, thing, yeah, you've got to do, you, yeah, can't. So it's just, yeah, I think 30s was just a time for laughing a lot, but also burying my head in the sand.
Yeah, yeah.
And feeling mature, but actually not behaving in a mature way.
It's quite difficult. You have to be quite confident, I think, and quite clear and focused to kind of put your flag in the sand and say, this is what I want, and this is who I am, and this is how it's going to be.
Yeah.
Because... life doesn't really work like that, but you have to do a little bit of that, I think. Otherwise, you'll just be, you know, working on hidden camera shows for the rest of your life, like I would be doing. if my mum hadn't died as a sacrifice. She thought, I can't watch another Hidden Camera show.
Yeah. I'd probably be going to do read-throughs because for
50 quid.
For 50 quid. And
for a
say,
day.
Can you pay my travel? You can't, no. Okay.
Oh, don't worry.
No worries.
But it's really great.
Because the star can't...
Yeah.
It's too busy to turn up.
Yeah.
It's and you go, yeah, but it might... Lead to
might
you're
lead
told,
somewhere. Cause
might
it's a great
lead
casting
somewhere.
Director.
Like, no, it's not going to lead
no,
anywhere.
You know
you're
what?
Just going to feel utterly at the lowest ebb when
I was
you
telling...
have to leave the room while makeup people are speaking to the actual cast.
Oh god!
And you just sort of shuffle out the door.
This is like a kind of. This is almost like not an intervention. This
I'm
is
going all, for a suck.
This is almost like I'm just now, sort of. Telling you all my resentments towards you.
It's but what we do, isn't it?
I remember the worst, like by far, like by, I mean, a million miles far, the worst table read I ever had to do was you were ill for a table read for Anna and Katie.
Oh, table
and
read
so
for my own show.
For your own show.
Yeah, I remember that.
So obviously all the parts were written for you. And you did them really well.
So
I had to do a table read and be you in your show. And it was just like, I'm never going to do this. Like, I don't want to do this like her. Like, this is her. But it was like, it was a pretty bad.
Oh, darling,
that's
I'm
pretty
so
bad,
sorry.
No,
but at least
fine.
You were in it and you were paid for the series.
I was
series.
In it, yeah. No, well, that
you
was
were,
really
you
fun.
Were the one of the linchpins.
Oh, but it wasn't until I was sitting down, I think, that I went, oh, this is going to be a bit embarrassing.
Oh, no.
You know, like trying to do an impression of your measurer's voice. Do you know what I mean that kind of thing?
Oh.
And then going, don't do that because that's not gonna. That's just gonna.
I'm
fall
sorry
flat.
That I
it's
made you
funny,
do that. I'm
can't
sorry.
I remember why you did. You're probably pregnant.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. I had an exploding bottom.
Did you?
No, I had.
Sounds
I had.
Unlikely.
I had a gastric problem.
I don't think we
I can't remember. I remember I had a stomach bug or something and I just couldn't have got on the tube and done it. It's bad.
I understand. But it's quite a comic situation.
Yeah, horrible.
Me being you.
It's good to have those things in your life to know you should never say yes to that again. Isn't
yeah.
it though?
Oh yeah. Oh,
like
yeah.
I'm never doing another table read.
Ever again. To know that there are things, you know, you think, oh, I mean, what's the worst that's going to happen? You know, I mean, nice, help them out. It's like, well, no, I probably just looked a
keep your
bit
pride.
Of a bell end.
Keep it, your pride about
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have to
I mean,
do
you,
that.
Yeah, you don't have to. That's the point, isn't
I
it?
I would have always done that, though. But yeah, but it was funny. It was that thing where you suddenly go, oh, no, I'm going to just look a bit of a bell end.
I'm sure you didn't.
Gonna, you know, it's fine. It doesn't matter. I remember you once saying to me, which is still the best way of explaining the sort of gender split between mothers and fathers, or the division of labour that I've ever heard, and I often repeat, where
this
when people say, yeah, it's really good,
is it?
Where people say, oh, well, you know, mothers are sort of naturally more nurturing and fathers are, you know, not and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's bollocks, because obviously everyone's different. And I know a lot of women who are not very nurturing at all and men who are and vice versa. Mm. But what you said, which really helped me understand, say, my husband's approach and reaction to parenting, was you said, the thing is, because I think it was maybe around the time that Will had been away for quite a long time, and then you'd gone filming maybe when Stan was quite young, and then you suddenly realised that, oh yeah, day one's quite hard being away from him, and then day two got a bit easier, and day three was actually quite easy.
Yeah.
And by the time you got home, you're a bit like, can I just watch this thing? You know what I mean? Like, you'd got into that thing of sort of reminding you that you are a kind of your own entity,
a human being
with, like, you know, you know.
Not a slave.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And that it sort of And I think that's quite useful to remember, that it's not, you know, because I think people often demonise their partners, whoever it is. And actually, you were pretty evenly split. But, yeah. You know, with me, you know, David obviously works much more. And so I spend more time with the kids. And then, so, you know, sometimes I wonder, how can he just come in and not want to do that? Or sort of think it's important that he catches up on MasterChef.
Yeah, because he came in yesterday and wasn't doing that. Yeah. And the day before and wasn't doing
exactly.
that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is easy.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going through a busy period at the moment. And even though I'm getting the train home every day, there is still that, oh, I've just got in and they're still out. I just stick the telly on rather than, you know, clear up the kitchen. Blah, 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 blah. Because you slip back into, I mean, it felt like that. I think that job that I was doing, he was three, and it was 2 weeks away from home, which was absolutely unimaginable at the time, like unthinkable. Like, I can't accept that job. How could I possibly go away for 2 weeks?
Was this in the Caribbean?
In the Caribbean.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, if it had been in Hull...
script, Sophie. I fell in love with it.
This is for...
it was Death in Paradise.
That Death in Paradise, that's right.
And the first morning when I woke up, it felt like literally like a punch. I felt like I was being punched in the stomach every hour, every time I thought about it. And then the next day I got up and looked out at the sea view and went for cocktails with the cast. And and then we went to some waterfalls and jumped off and went trekking through the jungles and went to see... and then had some more cocktails on the beach and had a pub quiz. And just... it got to the point towards the end of the 2 weeks where I feel like I probably missed a Skype that I could have done. But I had an absolute ball. I mean, it was just incredible. Like, 2 weeks in the Caribbean being paid for 5 days filming... But it was that moment, I think, halfway through, I went, you're here now, make the most of it. Like, mm-hmm. enjoy the fact that you can sleep in or not have to think, oh, it's 5 o'clock, what have I got in for dinner? Or, you know, just... And it was the first time, and he was three, the first time I felt like me again. And it's and that even makes you feel guilty because you're like, well, I shouldn't be feeling like this is the first time I felt like me in nearly 4 years.
There's such a tension, isn't there? Because there's something that reminds me a bit of sort of Stockholm syndrome. I sort of feel like the longer I am with my kids, the more...
The worse parent you are.
Probably. Yeah. And also the more sort of scared I am at leaving them and kind of, you know... Whereas, the less time, you know, when I do things that are stimulating and interesting and I remember who I am and I see my friends and I do that and then I see my kids, I'm way better, more fun, interesting mum than I am otherwise. Yeah. But I think everyone's slightly different, but I do think it gets a bit Stockholm syndrome-y in the sense that you kind of fall in love with your, I mean, obviously you do with your kid, but you kind of... You almost need...
You appreciate
there's
it.
There's a feeling of needing... I need to be with them. And actually then you realise, I don't need to be with them all the time.
Yeah.
And that doesn't do them any harm, really. And...
It doesn't.
Well, you know.
That's what you have to remember, is that, you know, you're not damaging them by earning money.
No, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I mean, that would be awful.
That would be awful.
You had to make that decision. But when after I got back, I mean, I spoiled him rotten, but we had such a laugh.
Yeah.
For at least 2 days.
Yeah.
So I went back
to
being grumpy mum.
Grumpy old shit.
Yeah.
So how has your relationship with Will changed or developed or, you know, how has it been affected by parenting? I mean, that's a huge question, but.
Yes. That's a good question. How's my relationship with Will? Well, I suppose being a parent forces you together, doesn't it? In a way that you would never have before that, because if you were a bit annoyed with each other, you could just sort of bugger off for a bit. Not like days.
Yeah,
just like, do you know what? I'm going to go into town or do my own thing for the rest of the day. But you're forced together. And so resentment can build up very, very quickly. if you feel like somebody's not pulling their weight or hasn't done something properly, you immediately, you just turn into a bit, like I now, I'm a nag now.
Oh, same, yeah.
I'm an awful nag.
Yeah.
But it's like, well, these things have to be done. And if you don't do them...
And how come you can't do them? No, how come you don't know to do them? Is, yeah.
Oh, we have had this discussion. And sometimes Will say, well, it's not important to me, so therefore I don't notice it, which is just absolutely infuriating. Absolutely infuriating. So then what I do is I go overboard with Stan and I'm like, shoes don't go there, do they? Passive aggressive, so Will can hear. Shoes go under the stairs, don't they, Stanley? Could you go and do that? There's a good boy. Oh, well done, thank you. You know...
Do you do that thing, which we... I think we do it less now, but we used to do a lot when they were babies, where we would talk to the baby... Basically passive-aggressive to each other. Oh, looks like mummy's not going to... Oh, looks like mummy's decided not to clear that up before she goes out. She's just going to leave daddy to do it, is she? Like that. So that we'd have that. This kind of conversation. Awful, in what world is the other person going to go, oh, I see.
Oh, hang on a moment.
He's making a good point. And in a really gentle and understandable way. Yeah, that was. We did that really quite a lot. It was quite funny, and we just stopped. We've got out of that phase, I think. Now.
Yeah, I think that the lack of sleep was. You know, that's a big.
I think that's basically.
There's no worse torture than, you know, that feeling of like I cannot keep my eyes open, and yet this child is awake.
Also, you're doing something for the first time, so you're doing something. You're looking after a child for the first time with less sleep than you would do the most important thing you've ever done.
Yeah.
So it's a very weird thing. You're having to make decisions and evaluations of, you know, how they're developing or changing, but on no sleep.
Yeah.
And it's so underestimated, I think. And I think I remember once when Zach was a baby and we'd had this freak night sleep that he then didn't replicate for quite a long time. And I remember putting my shoes on, all my socks on, and sitting on the side of the bed putting my shoes on, and I was chatting with David and we were having a nice chat or whatever. And I thought, oh, we're being really nice to each other. And then I thought, it's literally because we've had sleep. Literally, that is what it is. It's nothing to do, you know, so it's not that, you know, we don't get on or that we're mean people or whatever. We literally just are not sleeping. And
It's tiny little things. Like I remember walking upstairs and having to look at the stairs as I was walking up them because I couldn't really remember how to walk upstairs. And just thinking, if I don't look at the stairs, I'm gonna how will I know when to put my next foot up?
Yeah,
because I was just thoroughly just beaten by it,
yeah.
Like insane.
Yeah,
insane.
Yeah, yeah.
He stopped sleeping at 12 months and didn't sleep again until he was 2.5, and it was just like this is awful.
Yeah.
And that's why I think for ages, you know, I didn't create anything comedy wise because how can you be funny?
Spare. Yeah, exactly.
You've
got
no juice left in the tank.
No, yeah.
And I'm always just like amazed when you look at like, Bridget, her little girl. Well, no, her little girl was a bit older when she won the Edinburgh Award, but just like just being absolutely amazed that people can write stand-up comedy when they have a child under the age of 2.
Yeah.
So where you can't, I can't think, let alone create, let alone be funny.
Yeah.
And that's why I think I'm enjoying having a 5-year-old so much. It's so such good fun because I sleep every night.
Yeah.
For about 9 hours.
Yeah. Oh,
sorry.
That's all right. I have about 7, sometimes 8.
Bearing in mind, I was the person that needed at least 13 hours.
Okay, same. I know. It's so funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
How has parenthood changed your relationship with your parents, like your view of how you were parented? Has it made you more sympathetic or less sympathetic?
Very good question. I remember, so my childhood was essentially living with my father was a manic depressive who eventually committed suicide when I was seven. And so you can sort of imagine that household, can't you? And then when he was, after he died, mum just didn't cope at all. And so my childhood, I remember as being pretty miserable, chaotic, and very uncertain. Everything about life was uncertain. Like, you, as a kid, you're like a barometer. You pick up on everything, and yet you're being told nothing. So you make your own conclusions. And that, as a kid, is really unsettling, because you're like, well, I know something's not right, but you're all pretending it is. So you doubt yourself, so you become very unconfident. When there's one parent and they are grieving and angry and upset and going through all those processes, and yet treating those children like they are other adults.
Yeah.
So telling you know, how they're feeling all the time, losing their temper, screaming, shouting, then crying.
Yeah.
You're like, you'll do anything just to have a calm ocean.
Yeah.
So you learn to grow up very quickly. I remember that, you know, my childhood was gone like that. And so the way I treat Stan is to keep things absolutely as calm as possible. There's no screaming, get your shoes on. You know, I do shout at him to get his shoes on at least 70 or 80 times a day, and that's no exaggeration. But I'm keen for his life to have no chaos in it that I have caused. So there'll be chaos in his life because he's five.
Yeah.
But I'm keen. So that's probably why I didn't have any help with childcare.
Yeah.
Because it's the most important thing for me.
Consistency.
To have consistency in his life. And know where he is at the whole time.
Yeah.
Because for me, that's what brings confidence.
Yeah.
And so far, it's paid off. And maybe that's just his personality. And so there have been jobs that I haven't taken in the past, because it's like, I'm not going to take him to Liverpool to then be in a hotel room with a stranger that I've had to hire.
Yeah.
Just so I can do a job.
Yeah.
His growth, emotional growth, is up to me. It's up to me. And to me, calmness around kids is the most important thing. So yeah, I've put myself second, but that's the job of a mother.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Well, it's, I don't know. I think it is whatever feels right for you. Like, I kind of think I can hear people going, you know, I know people who would feel very stifled and frustrated by that, and so it's right for them to not do that. But your experience has led you to be, I think
I'm just trying to equip him with the skills to grow into a confident young human being.
But I also think most people are trying to do that, but I think that you can't get away from your experience as a child. So you can't get away from it, but you know, that has informed who you are. So and informed what your priorities are.
I mean, what I could be doing here is I could be raising an entitled little shit.
I don't think you are.
I could be, couldn't I? I could be doing completely the opposite, in the hope that he'll have
But you'll do. I sort of feel like we could, you know, the whole word. I hate
parenting.
The word parenting is shit, but it's assumed that there is a right or a wrong way, when in fact all we're doing is we're just human beings looking after other human beings, and either we're sort of compatible with those human beings And we're not. And then there's a whole load of stuff that goes on that we have no control over. Yeah. And basically, they're going to just be who they're going to be. And they're going to have flaws, like everyone. And they may be able to go back and go, oh, it's because my mum, you know, went off and and did a stupid podcast about parenting.
Yeah.
And
you know, it's totally... Absolutely. But I think, you know, coming as a... And this sounds stupid, but I'm probably the least confident performer that you will ever meet. Like I had as a child and into my teens no confidence whatsoever. Yeah. I still don't really, and I'm quite shy, and I can't help but feel if I'd had a less chaotic upbringing that perhaps I would have just felt. And so
I feel exactly
all I'm
the same,
all I'm trying to do is give him the best chance at being a confident person, because I think if you have confidence, everything else will follow.
I 100% agree, and I have exactly the same experience. I mean, I would be performing in Edinburgh and have a little voice in my head going, they hate you, they like all the other people on stage, they want you off, they want you off. And I'd feel almost sorry for the audience that they had to listen. Do you know what I mean? It was fucked up, and it really was so toxic.
Yeah.
And exactly that, like, it's the last thing I want my kids to have. But equally, probably the whole reason you went into, you know, you can flip that and sort of say maybe the whole reason you went into performing was because that was in your head. Do you know what I mean? Like, that actually going into, so actually you found yourself a kind of brilliant and fulfilling career through, because that's I think how things work. You know, you might have something that isn't quite right, and then you compensate for that in a positive way, and then therefore that does bring positivity to your life. So, you know,
yeah, maybe.
Come off it, mate.
What's the best bit of advice anyone ever gave you?
Don't listen to other people's advice. I think somebody said that to me. Just if someone, you know, somebody's got kids, tries to offer you advice, just...
ignore it.
Nod, smile, say thank you, and
thank you.
Absolutely
really
ignore it.
Yeah, I think that's good, yeah.
Actually, no, the best piece of advice Marcus Brigstocke gave us, which was, once the baby is born, keep your dressing gown on at all times. So if somebody pops round, they'll feel like you're not coping because you can't get dressed.
Yes.
And then they'll leave again quickly. That was the best.
That's actually really good. And what's the worst piece of advice anyone's ever given you?
Breastfeed. Genuinely. Like, genuinely.
How long did you breastfeed for?
Oh, I just couldn't. Just couldn't and didn't. Just was like, no.
Yeah.
This is, you know, my husband doesn't go and work in an office from 9 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock. He, you know, it's literally 50-50
care.
We can
share this. Yeah. We
can share this.
Yeah.
And this can be their time as well.
Yeah.
I just, the whole breastfeeding thing just drives me insane.
Yeah.
That people are feeling under any pressure to do it whatsoever.
Yeah. And finally, if you could go back in time, what would you tell your pregnant self?
Oh, I don't really know.
I would tell my pregnant self, don't worry about the birth. Prepare yourself for breastfeeding.
Yeah.
Don't think that's the difficult... Because actually, that's the thing that people worry about, is the birth. I was just so scared of tearing. You know, and you're
Were
just
you?
Like, yeah, and it's so stupid.
But that's inevitable, isn't it?
Well, A, and also, I remember my mum saying this. She's like, you don't feel it. And you can't believe that you could not feel that.
Yeah.
And that's the thing where you're like, oh, no, just you wait.
That's how much pain you're
Yeah, that's
be
how
in.
Much pain
your
you're in.
Your entire vagina was going to rip open and you
and
won't
you don't
feel
it. Yeah. It's like you cannot imagine what that will be like. So, and also I think there's a lot of scaremongering about that. I mean, obviously it can be really bad, but also like it is designed to go, but it's not like you've just got this kind of like plunger of a hole that's just like wobbling about. Do you know what I mean? It's like
plunger,
no, it
will,
do you know what I mean, like one of the, you know, like the bottom of a plunger.
Yeah.
That's how I imagined. You know, I sort of thought you'd give birth and then it would just be flopping open like that.
Did you?
No, I didn't, but...
Oh, I see.
But like, there's this idea that unless you do, you know, your Kegel exercises and if you tear, blah, blah, you'll basically never be able to have sex again and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's all kind of bollocks because your body's designed to just sort of ping back.
I mean, people have been doing it for a while.
Yeah.
Haven't they?
It's been fine.
That, yeah, there was... That thing about I really missed sushi when I was pregnant.
Yeah.
Like I really missed it. And then I was like, oh, do you know what? I'm just going to eat sushi. Because to be honest, you know, millions of Japanese women have been doing it for thousands of years. So it's probably okay.
Yeah.
And it's just editing out.
You know. I was definitely much more, I was so relaxed when I was pregnant with Sadie. I literally did. I probably drank a glass of wine. In fact, when I found out I was pregnant with Sadie, I had a glass of wine. Like, it almost to sort of deal with the fact that I was pregnant. I mean, I ate sushi all the time. There was literally nothing I didn't eat. I think I didn't have caffeine. That was my one concession. I didn't have caffeine.
And that's the thing, you are allowed, so...
I'll have to get
two cups
again.
Of coffee a day.
Yeah.
So who feels silly now?
Well, Anna Crilly, thank you very much for coming to talk to me.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. As a parent going back to work, your mental health, strong mental health of a mother and a father is the most important provision you can make for your child, I think. So it's whatever you need to do to maintain your mental health makes you the best parent possible. My theory. Does that make sense?
That is, I think, pretty fucking top-notch advice.
So if it's jumping out of an aeroplane, then you should go and do that.
If it's going clubbing, if it's smoking.
You're happy, they're happy.
Yeah.
I've got my arm in the air.
Like you're jumping out of an aeroplane. Anna Crilly, thank you so much for... talking to me today.
Thanks. Don't have any more kids?
No, I won't. Thanks so much to Anna Crilly. Well, that's it. Next time I'm speaking to Daisy Haggard of Episodes and Man Straight Woman. I'm sounding slightly subdued because I've just had to turn off the baby monitor to the sound of my son's crying so that I can record this. And I'm slightly confused as to whether that is a good thing or a bad thing. It's probably it's a bit of both, probably, isn't it? If you're interested in The Half, which is the brilliant play Anna was in, written by Danielle Ward, also starring Margaret Caborn Smith. Follow them on Twitter. I'm sure there'll be more performances than that is at The Half Play on Twitter. I think she also pops up in Succession, the amazing HBO series, which is currently on many platforms. But yes, thank you for listening. Please get in touch if you have any constructive criticism, because it's all useful. And I hope to see you again.